Ghostly Thistle presents The Antique Shop. Episode 33, The Oracle. I must have mentioned these hundreds of times. They're always there in the shop, like Kronos and the Madam, but do a lot less talking. No one ever looks at them for more than a second, and that includes me. They stand against walls, tucked away in corners, hidden behind smaller items, but they're always there, like huge flies on the wall. No one's ever bought one, to my knowledge, and I'd never really given it much thought. Until one day, I got curious. It was just Finn and Kronos in the shop with me. Reed had a hospital appointment to remove the last day's stitches. In order to get out, he taken part in the world's most intense and competitive card game, I took a wander round the shop, hoping to find anything to entertain me. A book that mysteriously fell through the ceiling, a puzzle collection that timed you and gave you a score once you'd finished, or if I was really lucky, another prison book that I could liberate someone for and regret for months. No, that day. As I was meandering down the aisles, my eyes passed over a wardrobe I've seen so many times we should be on first name terms. It's sandwiched between a vanity table and an old record player. It's no grand by any means, and doesn't stand much taller than myself. It's quite slender, and made of a light-coloured wood where the whorls and lines are visible in the grain. I can imagine it in the corner of some small boarder's room in the early 20th century, used to house a few pressed shirts and their best suit. I wondered what was inside, if there was anything. I'd never checked in any of the wardrobes in the shop, but what if there were more things inside? Would people still find them? Curious, I wound my way across a typewriter case and a few paintings propped upright against other things until I stood in front of the doors. Two ring pulls were at waist height, and as I curled my hands around them, I hesitated. This was the shop. What if a monster was inside? What if I got sucked in? I wasn't stupid. Even if Narnia did exist, it wouldn't be a land full of talking lions and noble warriors. It'd be hell, where the lion would rip your head off and then someone had scavenged your corpse. Then again, this was the shop, where no every item was enchanted. This could be an empty wardrobe, and I was fretting for no reason. Stealing myself, I flung open the doors, ready to face the horrors of the interior. Only to find nothing. No clothes, no ravenous lion, no even an odd shoe. It was just a wardrobe, after all. I let my hands slacken for the ring pulls, inspecting the marks imprinted on my hand I was gripping onto it that tightly. Disappointed, I searched the inside of the wardrobe, hoping I'd missed something. A hidden doorknob, a false back or sides. After my inspection, I bitterly concluded it was, indeed, just a wardrobe. Of all the things in the shop, it would be the one with the most potential that was mundane. As I was about to close the doors and go in search of something more interesting, I saw a piece of paper wedged between the floor and the back wall of this wardrobe, as though someone had made a temporary fix. The wardrobe itself was deeper than it looked through the outside, so I knelt on its floor and reached back to the paper, managing to get it between my thumb and index finger. As I pulled, something pulled back. Like there was someone else on the other end of that paper who'd had the same idea as me. I tried to shimmy the paper out, pulling from one side to the other, but nothing worked. It was time for brute strength, and with all my might I pulled on that paper, only to find myself being pitched forwards, straight into the back wall of the wardrobe. I closed my eyes, expecting to smack my face into the wood. But when I opened them, I found myself stumbling forward onto dry ground, catching my balance before I sprawled out. It's sunny, heat lapping against my bare arms. The sky is bright blue, the occasional cotton white clouds swirling in the distance, chasing each other across the horizon. There are a lot of people about. Some walk past me, others pause to take in the view to the distant mountains, or the many statues that line the pathway where we are. It's a built-up area, but these buildings aren't inhabited. There are no houses or shop fronts. A single wide path cuts through them at sharp angles, leading people up to the top of the mountain that we're on, where the largest building looms. Glancing around, there are statues everywhere, on top of tall plinths, down on the ground, made of brass or stone, carved or moulded into shapes of animals and people. The statues wear the same clothing as the people around me. Light linen tunics fastened by buttons or brooches, sandals on their feet, glistening jewellery on their fingers and round their necks. The stone statues are painted in vibrant colours, emeralds and sapphires, scarlets and yellows. It feels as though they could come to life at any moment, have a conversation with a passerby. I walk up the incline, following the designated path, past buildings that remind me more of mausoleums, but appear to be something else. Initially, I thought this place was a graveyard. These luxurious stone buildings with shields hung on the walls and frescoes carved above the stone columns, nothing but crypts to someone of note. As I began to walk past them, to peer inside, to try and read the foreign script, I thought they were more like temples, places of worship. But rather than praising a deity, they were praising a nation, or a previous triumph. The statues had the same feel to them. Rather than honouring the dead, they were dedicated by the living in memory of some great historic moment. It was as I passed one of these buildings, with shields hanging up inside, that I recognised a symbol painted on the front. The Greek letter lambda was emblazoned in coal black against a scarlet background. I'm no a 300 fan, but wasn't that the symbol Sparta used to use? The more I gazed round, the more I noticed. The Athenian owl was carved into a building or two, the winged horse of Corinth. Finally, the statue that explained it all was a large one, at least 8 metres tall. It was a column made up of three twisting ropes of copper that wound around each other until the top, where they splayed into three snakes' heads. Laid on top of the heads was a brilliant golden tripod and cauldron that sparkled in the sunlight. That was the serpent column, the one dedicated to the Delphic Oracle. This was ancient Greece. No, this isn't the first time I've been yeeted back into the past. Was this the real past? Could I interact with people? The universe decided to answer my question by getting someone to shout at me. It was a woman standing behind a wooden stall full of trinkets and medals and other offerings. Looking directly at me, she beckoned me over. Believe me, I turned around and everything just to check. It was definitely me she wanted to see. I gingerly walked over to her, and as soon as I got within speaking distance, she began to surmise that I must be there to see the oracle. Pointing further up the incline, following the path past even more wonderful and lavish buildings and statues, to the grand temple that towered above everything else, she ushered me in that direction. I go to ask her something, open my mouth, but I canny. I simply grunt a reply to this woman, and she then tells me if I want any more advice to come and see her. I start to glance down at myself and realise I'm dressed the same way as everyone else. Layers of linen, buttoned together at the seams and belted at the waist. My skin is a golden sun-kissed olive, far away from the peely-wally reality. I'm evidently no myself here. I'm a lot fitter too. I can see the muscles pushing against the skin on my forearms. Not really knowing what else to do, I follow the path up to the Temple of Apollo, the grand edifice in the centre of this labyrinth of offerings. My dad loves a good documentary, so I watched a lot of them growing up. It's the only reason I recognised the Serpent Column. Another name for the oracle at Delphi was the Pythia, or Pythia, and along with a tripod, the oracles used both as their symbols. The main temple is dedicated to Apollo, who, amongst other talents, was the god of foresight or prophecy. Three women at any time could hold the title of oracle, and they were usually chosen for the local population, as Delphi is the name of the local town. People would travel far and wide to see the oracle, asking her advice, and some nations put a lot of stock in what she said. Most are vague, and shockingly only make sense after the fact. But fake or no, the oracle had copious amounts of influence in ancient Greece. Whether or no to colonise, whether or no to start a war, the oracle would be consulted. I continued following the path until I came out at the wide expanse surrounding the temple itself, by far the largest and most imposing building in the entire complex. Many carved stone columns supported a tiled roof, with a fresco of the founding myth of the oracle carved in brass around the edge, too far up to truly see. This place was packed with people waiting to get into the temple, and on the outskirts were stall owners selling everything from coins to small live animals that you could sacrifice to Apollo. As I glance round the crowd, I hear someone else hollering at me and waving me over to one of these stalls. And I hesitate, afraid that a poor chicken will be foisted onto me and I'll be expected to kill it. Eventually, I go over to this man, dressed in as much finery as there was space on his arms and neck. He tells me the oracle has been waiting for me, and that because I have priority, I can go straight in, past the queue. Again, I open my mouth to say something, to ask why, but I can't. It looked like I was about to see the oracle for myself. In the documentary my dad and I watched, no one really knew for certain what the inside of the temple looked like, or even how the oracle worked. Would I get to see it now? How was I supposed to ask her anything when I couldn't open my mouth? The grand doors to the temple are pulled open, and as soon as they're closed behind me, silence descends. Rather than an open space, like a church or mosque, with high ceilings and natural light, There's another door a few metres in front that leads to a smaller chamber. I'm escorted through this one into a musky, hot room, no unlike a sauna. The silence in the main temple echoed, the slightest shuffling of feet or sandals as loud as the crowds outside. But in this sacred place, there was only the crackle of candles. I'm no alone. There are attendants scattered round this space, holding bowls, writing utensils, or standing on ceremony. I make my way past them and up to the top of the room where a woman sits on a tripod. This woman, dressed in pristine white linen, jewels and beads hung on her necklace and wrist, brooch sparkling in the candlelight, must be the oracle herself. One of them, at least. I approach, and the oracle asks me what I want to know. I didn't say anything in reply, but everyone acts like I did, nodding and understanding. I'm left to glean my answer for the words she says next. Raising her hands to the low ceiling, she praises the god Apollo and tells me I have a great destiny to fulfill, should I choose to accept it, that I could be the next hero of legend. It all depended on the choice I made when I left the temple. My destiny, she said, was waiting. It's good to know that psychics haven't changed much in 2,000 years. That was the end of my slot, and the attendants ushered me out the way I'd come. The cacophony outside felt like emerging from a sound booth. There was a rush of noise and a flood of people. The sunlight caused me to squint for a few seconds as my eyes adjusted to the brightness for the peaceful gloom of the temple interior. I didn't have long to gather my thoughts and figure out what to do next when across the courtyard, through the queue, is a commotion. Steel clangs ring out and taunts are exchanged as a group of three scruffy-looking men circle a scrawny-looking one. I start moving towards the noise, only to realise I suddenly have a sword and shield in my hands. I didn't even realise I had these on me. I make my way through the crowd as the blazing sun watches until I'm upon this group where it's clear the three armed men are trying to steal for the smaller one. Now, I know sometimes I can be a bit confrontational, but I swear I've never been in a proper fight. Punched a lad, aye. He had it coming, and I was a bairn. But a full-on swords-out, try-no-to-die fight? Not once. To my dismay, instead of throwing a few sarcastic insults at the three to make them piss off, they just attacked me instead. Didn't even give me a chance to open my mouth. Know that I probably could've. By Apollo's luscious locks of hair, these bastards were actually trying to kill me. The more amazing thing was that I knew how to use this sword and shield. I was given as good as I got, and I managed to incapacitate one. But as I was about to deal the finishing blow, one of the other two got straight past my guard and plunged their short swords right through my chest. Do you ever do something, be it cut yourself with a knife whilst you're cooking or burn yourself on some overdone toast? It doesn't hurt immediately. It's like your brain hasn't caught up yet. But you know what you've done, and you know that in less than a second, you're going to be in immense pain. Being impaled through the chest was a wee bit like that. Except the moment of pain never came. I felt myself begin to crumple, my legs buckling and giving way. But I was in no pain. I didn't think I was dying. Before I could greet the stones on the ground, everything went black for a second. Apart from me. And I was in limbo, unable to move. There was text in the blackness, floating there in English, handwritten in cursive red. Game over. Before I knew what was happening, the world reverted to colour and blistering sunshine. I was standing outside the temple, as though I'd just come for the oracle. The temple doors were just about to close behind me. The world had reset. The vendors were in the middle of saying the same thing as they'd been before. The same goat I'd seen be sacrificed a few seconds ago was just about to be so again. Squinting through the crowd, I even saw the small group who'd done me in the first time, their swords drawn and their taunts becoming loud enough for me to hear across the courtyard. Was I in a game? Was this wardrobe some kind of VR? I know a few people who'd love VR to be this real. Only this talk about a great destiny, these helpful strangers pointing me in the right direction, and my inability to speak, all reminded me of these games I'd seen my pals play through on a casual Friday night in. Only this was a bit modern for an antique wardrobe, if that's even what it was. They didn't have RPGs back in the 19th century. As I hear the taunts of the men who killed me, I'm tempted to have another go. But as much as being stabbed didn't hurt, I wouldn't want it repeated. Even remembering how it looked makes me feel ill. Instead, I return to where I woke up in this bronzed demigod's body at the entrance to Delphi and find the original woman I spoke to. She waves me over and asks me if I'm sure I'm done. I decide being impaled once is enough and tell her I am. The first time during this whole ordeal I've been able to speak for myself. I feel the same sensation of being pulled forwards, losing my balance and about to land face first. Except I overcorrect and lean backwards, eventually toppling out the wardrobe and onto the narrow path, taking a few magazines with me. Reed appears to help me up, meaning he's back for the hospital. How long was I in there for? He glances at the wardrobe, nods his head, and tells me he found it a few weeks ago. He's been meaning to go back in and try it again. I know Reed finds cool things in the shop. When he's no playing games with Finn and Kronos, he's usually rifling through the antiques. When he finds one, he comes to me to gloat, like a bairn during show and tell at school. I ask him why he didn't tell me about the wardrobe. I tried not to let the sting show in my voice, but I'm not sure I was that successful. Reed, curt as always, said that even though I'm in the shop, I'm no really there. I'm somewhere distant. I barely speak unless it's to a customer. I laugh it off, make a joke, something stupid. All the while, barely being able to look at him, because all I can think of is fate and the car accident and how it was all my fault. In order to get out of they're the same word, it's fine. In order to... Oh no. We're off to a good start. It was just a wardrobe, after all. It was just a wardrobe, after all. It was... Oh, that was predictable. There are a lot of people about. Some walk past me. Others pause to take in... Ow. There you go. Second week running. You're not going to be able to hear that, but that was my spine cracking as well. The main temple is dedicated to Apollo, who, among other talents, was the god of foresight. Oh no, was the god of frogs in the throat. This woman, dressed in pristine white linen, jewels and beads hung on her necklace and... Oh, there's a lot of bloopers in this episode, Christ. I make my way through the crowd as the blazing sun watches until... Thank you for listening to episode 33 of The Antique Shop. Episode 34 will be released in 2 weeks' time. Yeah, I probably should put a caveat at the beginning of this. If you don't like history, if you don't care about the history of this episode, I will see you next episode. But if you do like to hear about the history, then by all means, listen to the next 10 minutes, maybe, hopefully. Hello. This is the section of the show where I bombard you with historical facts, because this has been a historical episode. I'm also having to re-record this because I made such an absolute shambles of it the first time. So let's see if it goes any better. So the Oracle of Delphi, or the Oracle at Delphi, or the Pythia, I think that's all the names that I know so far. So it's a real thing. Most of what I said in the episode is true. In fact, I think all of what I said is true, because I do try to be as historically accurate as I can be, but I do obviously take creative license with a few details. Here is the offensively short rundown of the Oracle at Delphi. So archaeologists and historians tend to believe that the oracle was founded or created or started roughly between 800 BC and 700 BC in what we now refer to as Greece. I can't remember what the actual area is called. It's been that long since I've read the textbook. Although historical texts, and obviously I think it's the Iliad. Yes, the Iliad. The Trojan War. Yeah, the Iliad by Homer obviously makes it seem like it's a lot older, but archaeologically speaking, or archaeological evidence tends to imply somewhere between 800 and 700 BC. I think it's pretty much established in the ancient world by about 700 BC. But I think the oldest kind of foundations and evidence that they've found at the site dates to about 800 BC. So roughly between there, the oracle comes into being. The oracle, as the name implies, was a female. And there was three females who could hold the position of oracle at the same time, or at the one time. They spoke with the voice of the god Apollo, so this is the Greek god Apollo, and who obviously was the god of foresight and prophecy. So you'd ask the Pythia or oracle a question, and she would give you a predictably vague answer. There doesn't seem to be a consensus on how she gave that answer. So some people, or some historians and archaeologists, think that she spoke in, not rhymes, but kind of something similar to that. Others think she spoke directly. Others think she didn't speak at all. She just rambled some random words, and it was actually the priests at the temple that would translate it into nice rhyming poems. So yeah, there is a lot of mystery surrounding the oracle itself, how it worked, because the bad thing about the historical texts that we do have, the primary sources and the contemporary sources, is that the oracle was so famous by the time these historians are writing about it that they don't mention certain details that would be obvious or would be known by a Greek person. But obviously, 2,000 years later, we don't know the things that they knew. So we only know what the historians wrote down, and all the other obvious day-to-day things, like how it worked, like how what the process was like and stuff, is like we have to piece together from different sources, and it's a lot of guesswork. We don't know why I'm saying we, I'm not a historian. So the oracle, I've always been fascinated by. I think it's just such a fascinating concept. I probably should tell you why, actually. So the oracle, despite what we would think, or despite how it would be treated these days, was a very important part in ancient Greek culture and ancient Greek history. So I don't know if any of my listeners are historians or do know an awful lot about ancient Greece. So what we refer to now as ancient Greece would not have been a single country. It was made up of different city-states. So obviously Sparta is the most famous one. Athens is probably equally so. You've got Corinth, you've got Argos, you've got a few others. And they referred to themselves by the same name, which actually I think is still the Greek word for how they refer to themselves in Greek. I think it's Hellas, but don't quote me on that. So yeah, they all referred to them. They kind of knew that they shared a culture, because they did. They shared a culture and religion and food and stuff like that. But they were very aware that they were of their own city-states. They were very proud of their city-states. The most similar thing I can think of is in the UK. We're all part of the UK. There's four countries that are part of the UK. And we're all British, you know, we all kind of have that general society. But in our separate countries, we have our own culture. And we refer to ourselves as being from that specific country rather than being like, oh, we're British. I think a lot of people wouldn't be too proud of admitting they're British these days. So that's how I've kind of looked at it. In that we all share a culture and we share, not even a religion anymore, but a political system at least in the UK at the minute. But we do still have our own separate cultures in each of those four kingdoms that make up the UK. So that's kind of what ancient Greece was like. It was apart from it without the UK, but there was no united city-states. They did make like alliances and stuff, but the alliances never really worked out all that well, and they didn't really last all that long. So that's ancient Greece. So ancient Greece, as we refer to it, is not actually an entire entity. It's not an entire country. It's made up of different city-states. But all of them had the oracle and obviously the religion in common. And the oracle is essentially a religious sect. And mostly all of those city-states, in fact, I think it's probably all of them at some point, consulted the oracle about certain decisions that they would make. So mostly it was if they should go to war and if they should colonise a certain part of the Aegean Sea. So that's the other thing the ancient Greeks did, if nobody knew. They colonised certain parts of the Aegean Sea, so like what modern day Turkey, I think southern Italy, the islands of Italy got colonised as well. It was like a few places. I don't completely know the geography of the colonisation, but they sent people out to live and to colonise these places, and they became essentially Greek city-states in their own right. But the decision to actually do that in the first place would have been referred to the oracle. I can't remember, I don't know if it's ever mentioned in the book that I read. I don't know if the oracle ever said, no, you shouldn't do that nobody ever did it. But I think it's important to understand that in ancient Greece, I think religion was a very much a strong part of society, not like it is today. Well, in the UK, at least, it's not a very strong part of society. And so people took religion quite seriously back in ancient Greece. So I think if the oracle, essentially the oracle did have the final say in a lot of things to do with city-states within a certain period of time. So the oracle was very famous for hundreds of years, and it didn't actually stop functioning until, I think it's the 5th century CE, so about the 400s CE. Don't quote me on that though, because I can't quite remember. It's been a few months since I've read the textbook, so I don't know the exact dates. But it was still technically functional all the way up until like the Roman Empire, because obviously Rome expanded a lot, so it essentially took over most of Europe. And it kind of took over Greece as well. And the oracle was still functional, although it wasn't popular, like people weren't visiting it all the time. It didn't have all these offerings and stuff. Delphi, yes, Delphi is an actual place in Greece. I think it's still called Delphi, but it's like ruins now. And it was a town. So Delphi is the name of the town. It's not really the name of the oracle. And what I said was true about the oracles, the females being chosen, usually were chosen from the population of Delphi, so certain families. And the oracle was this town's main income, essentially. And they were in control of the oracle. I don't mean in control of what she said, I mean in control of who she was and who the women were and who got to see her, etc, etc. Because, yeah, the oracle is not a business. It wasn't open all the time. There was only certain days of the year and certain times of the year that it was open. I think it's something ridiculous, like 9 days of the year that it would be open for questions, and that was it. It was really, really short periods of time, I think, if I remember correctly. I do have a reading list on my website, or on the website, so ghostlythistle.com, and it's under a tab called Books I've Read / Listened To, and it'll be 2021. One of my goals this year was to read more, and I meant read fiction, but I ended up reading non-fiction as well. There's a list of all of the, essentially, all of the books that I have read or listened to, mostly listened to. Who has time to read a physical book these days? And you will find all of the reference books from ancient Greece, because I went through quite a few textbooks. One of them was on the Oracle, and a few of them were just general, like, ancient Greek culture and stuff like that. And then Stephen Fry decided he was going to do some books on the Greek mythos, which are amazing. I would very much recommend them. I went down that rabbit hole. So yeah, essentially, I fell down a massive ancient Greek rabbit hole in the summer, all thanks to Assassin's Creed Odyssey. I think everybody's probably heard of the Assassin's Creed franchise, because they made a film about it, didn't they? So a film of it, but I think it was panned. I never saw it myself. But yeah, I recently got into gaming in the last maybe 2 or 3 years, and I had a bit of time in the summer and a bit of the time in the last few months. And yeah, I played Assassin's Creed Odyssey. That was the first Assassin's Creed game that I played. And it's set in ancient Greece. I won't spoil it, but I do recommend it, because I think it's one of my favourite games now. Even though it's probably not the best Assassin's Creed game, but it's the only one I've played so far, so it's really good. But yeah, it essentially ignited this hidden passion that I had for ancient Greece. So that's why there's been a lot of ancient Greek references. Maybe not a lot. I've definitely mentioned it once before in the podcast, like a few episodes ago. I think I mentioned something about ancient Greek heroes. See, that's why, because when I was writing these, I was essentially knee deep in an ancient Greek rabbit hole. So there's a lot of references to ancient Greece. I do apologize if anybody doesn't like ancient Greece, but I find ancient Greece really fascinating. Like, anyway, I will not bore you. I think that's all I wanted to say about the Oracle. I would definitely recommend at least having a look at the Wikipedia page. I've always found the Oracle fascinating, even when I was like a teenager. I remember learning first about it when I was about 16, 17. And I found it really interesting then, and I still to this day find it really interesting. And I think it's because I don't know about anybody else, but I've always thought that the ancient, especially in the West, the ancient Greeks were so advanced for the time, not with regards to technology, obviously, but then again, but with their culture, like they were the ones who created democracy, or not created democracy, but they were the ones that essentially spread democracy in the West. And I think a civilization that was so sophisticated, I think is the word I kind of would choose. So for a society that was so sophisticated, the fact that they couldn't really do anything important or make any important stately decisions without talking to an oracle who purportedly, like, giving messages from Apollo, the god Apollo, is just absolutely baffling to me. All the mathematical and kind of scientific discoveries, all the philosophy, all the philosophy of, like, the ancient Greeks, you know, how smart they were and how kind of clever they were, and then you get things like the Oracle at Delphi, where, you know, nobody could really make a decision about anything important without talking to her. And it just absolutely, I think that is just such a juxtaposition for me that I just love it. So yes, I would definitely recommend either, I think the book that I read has an audiobook, but I might be wrong about that. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you next time.